Good morning. It's a joy to be here. For those of you who have been attending our services regularly, you may be thinking a little bit along the same lines as I've been thinking. Especially over the course of the last four Sundays here, the composition of the congregation. 3 weeks ago today, we had a baptism service here, and there were some visitors here. 2 weeks ago, the European Mennonite Music Weekend, and there were a lot of visitors here that Sunday. Maybe last Sunday was a little more typical, and then today we have maybe quite a number of our families and home folks away, and we have a goodly number of visitors here with us this morning. All very unique services, but the reality is that the presence of God is here this morning, just as it has always been when we gather together as His people, because His presence is with us. And so it was good to experience that and just to realize that again this morning, that God's presence is here. And it's good to see you here today. You're very welcome here in this service. Some of you followed Ben Heinzel yesterday. Not literally, but maybe you were able to follow him on the app that was sent out to some of you folks, where he was cycling across Ireland all in one day, chasing the sun with, 200 and some other cyclists, and started in Belfast and ended up, was it in County Mayo or County Sligo? I can't remember. Late last evening. 200 and some miles? 211 miles in one day. That's quite an accomplishment. That's quite a feat. Quite amazing. We're enamored by accomplishments and feats like that. And they stir our interest. I'm going to go back to the book of Nehemiah today, so you can turn there. And I want to remind us that there was also quite an accomplishment that took place in Nehemiah. We've been studying Nehemiah over the course of the last number of months. And one of the amazing things that we've learned is that this wall that had been in ruins for generations was rebuilt in 52 days. And we've looked at Nehemiah, and we felt the pain that he felt when he first learned of this situation in Jerusalem. We looked at his prayers. We studied some of the planning that he made, some of the plans that he made. And then we looked at how he partnered with people, regular people, common people like you and me, not necessarily skilled builders, but he partnered with them, and they partnered together with God in rebuilding the walls. We also looked at, as this is more recently in the last few weeks, or the last few sermons, how there was opposition. Nehemiah and his builders were persecuted by Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. And we likened them to our adversary, the devil. And we talked about his tactics, which are very predictable. The devil is powerful, but he has a very predictable way of attacking people, either by being an angel of light or acting as a roaring lion. But we also learned that he is resistible. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. He is not all powerful. And we made some comparisons to the situation that Nehemiah faced with Sanballat and his cronies. And we left in our last sermon with this thought that I was again mulling over in the last several days of the work continuing in Nehemiah chapter 4, with the builders having a trowel in one of their hands and a sword in their other hand. A beautiful picture of the work of building the kingdom of Jesus Christ continuing on, but there's an awareness there of the enemy. and guards are in place. We're going to look at a completely new challenge this morning in Nehemiah chapter 5. If you've been involved at all with other people, with a community of believers, with the church or a mission endeavor, you're going to know and understand and realize what this problem is. You may have seen it, you may have experienced it. I've titled the message this morning, A Wall Between the Builders. A Wall Between the Builders. Nehemiah chapter 5, and it's roughly divided into three portions. I'm going to look at each of these three portions this morning. And for a bit of a change, I'm going to end up, Lord willing, reading all the verses in Nehemiah 5. We haven't read all of the verses leading up to this chapter, but I do intend to read the verses this morning. So I'm going to begin with the first section, Nehemiah 5, verse 1. There was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were also some who said, "We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we may buy grain because of the famine." There were also those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards." A wall between the builders. So we're going to look at four things in this first section. And I think it'll help to bring the dilemma that they were facing, the situation that they were facing, into focus. First of all, as they were building the wall, they were putting a lot of their time and their energy into this project. Of late, they had even been staying up late, working during the day, and Nehemiah had instructed them not to go home at night to spend time with their families, but to stay on the project and serve as guards. And so you can see how this must have been for the builders. They worked hard all day, physical labor, and then they weren't able to go home at night and relax with their families, spend time with them, because they were meant to guard. So this was a challenging situation. And then, as we get into this, to add to all this busyness and strife and what we might look at in our world today and say it's not sustainable to live like this, there were these things that were going on in the background that I just read about that now came into the forefront and was threatening the work. And we're going to learn as we read this chapter that there was not much building, not much of any building taking place in chapter 5. So the people, we see in verse 2, they were many. They had probably had big families. And because their sustenance was so closely tied to the land, they needed to produce their food in order to live. But now instead they were busy working, they were busy building, and even their farming was suffering. And it says their families, they were suffering from hunger. They wanted to have food so that they could eat and live. Just a truth to keep in mind, we're all about sacrificing. And we're going to talk about sacrificing for the good of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And families need to sacrifice for the work of the kingdom, but especially for you fathers, and this comes a week later than Father's Day, we should never sacrifice our families themselves, because our families are a big part of the work of the kingdom. So let's not ignore our families as we are working at building the kingdom. So this was one problem Their children were hungry. They needed to eat. Another thing, and we see this in verse 3, while this project was going forward, there was a famine. We would call a famine an act of God, just something unplanned. They didn't plan for it. But because these people lived hand to mouth, this was serious to them. Do you think that being in the middle of a famine would affect morale on a building project? Probably so. So as they came to their job every morning, they were thinking about feeding their families. How are we going to do this? And now there's a famine. Then in verse 4, on top of this, there was this small matter, not so small, of the king's taxes. The king of Persia had the right to enact a tax on these people for what they owned, their land, their property. And regardless if they were in the middle of a famine or not, they had to pay these taxes. Now, you know that paying taxes is not something that really thrills any of us, but imagine when funds are tight anyway, in a situation of a famine, there is still this expectation for this taxation. This could be a real burden, a real stress. Do you think this affected their ability, their focus on the goal of completing this wall? But then, verse 5 beats all, because in this situation with these hardships that were piling on the people while they were trying to work, there were wealthy Jews who had money, who were taking advantage of the situation by loaning money out at interest. And likely, according to verse 11, if you figure that up, that would be a 1% per month that they were likely charging a 12% annual rate of interest. But they were putting their brothers in a situation that was not going to work. They weren't able to pay. And so, as the people indicated in their complaint, these people had borrowed this money at this rate of interest. They weren't able to pay, but they had used their farms, their properties, and even their children as collateral. And now these wealthy Jews were taking this money, or taking this property, and taking even children, sons and daughters, putting them into slavery. And that would even, it would even indicate that in verse 5, some of our daughters have been brought into slavery, that there were men who were taking these ladies and making them their concubines. And these were brothers in the church, or in the fellowship, in the congregation, among the people of God. Do you think this affected the morale of the building project? Now, this very kind of thing has been happening for years and years in the world. And if you know and study the history of Ireland, that is certainly not foreign to this island. These kinds of things that I've just read about are blots, they're stains in the history of humanity. They're very real. And in different parts of the world, they're taking place even today. But it should never be that this is taking place among the people of God. Here, we see a wall dividing the builders. Did this threaten the work of building? Has the work of the kingdom of God and the building of it been threatened by similar or maybe even lesser problems and challenges in our day? If I would ask each one of you individually, you could probably give me at least one and maybe a dozen examples. I can think of two that I'll share this morning. Amy and I were talking to some friends recently, and they told us that in their former church, they said we didn't have communion for years. We couldn't have communion. We just couldn't have communion. And they didn't elaborate on that, but that church finally dispersed. And I know people in that church. I know people who used to be part of that church. That's sad. I'm thankful that those people are in other places. Many of those people are now faithfully serving and being a part of other fellowships. But what God was wanting to do in that particular congregation was left undone because there was dissension among the people of God. Number two, I have a friend who worked for a Christian organization some years ago, and he said when he arrived at work, the first day or the first days, to his surprise, he realized that the directors of that organization were at odds with each other, and there was strife. And there was this palatable feel of tension. And it was difficult for him. Thankfully, that organization is still thriving. The people that were involved in that situation are no longer part of that organization. But whatever God wanted to do with them in that work, do you think it was hampered because of the strife, because of the wall? We could make many applications, and we would realize many situations. I think it's good for us to be introspective as well and think about ourselves. I'm going to look at Nehemiah's response now because I think we can learn from Nehemiah in how he handled this situation. None of us have been given exactly the same responsibility that Nehemiah was given. We're not a governor. We're not a foreman of thousands of wall-building workers. We're not a cupbearer, but we have responsibilities such as teachers and managers and foreman and chief and father and mother and pastor and supervisor. And all of us interact with people who have been given responsibility. And I think we can all learn from the response of the people who interacted with Nehemiah. Let's read about it. I'm going to continue reading, beginning in verse number 6. And I became very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. After serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, "Each of you is exacting usury from his brother." So I called a great assembly against them, and I said to them, "According to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. Now, indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us?" And then they were silenced and found nothing to say. Then I said, "What you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please, let us stop this usury. Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, and also a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them." So they said, "We will restore it, and we will require nothing from them. We will do as you say." And then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. Then I shook out the fold of my garment and said, "So may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied." And all the assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. What I say next, you may consider to be steps to resolving conflict from Nehemiah. One thing I noticed about Nehemiah is that his emotions were greatly stirred. And I think they were stirred because he cared. He was not an apathetic person. And we can ask the question sometimes, are Christians allowed to be angry? Well, God has created us with emotions. So the answer to the question, are Christians allowed to be angry? Yes, if your anger is at the things that are done against the righteousness of God. Yes, if you can do it without sinning or giving place to the devil. Yes, if you are swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Yes, if your anger motivates you to bring resolution to the situation in a way that God would be pleased. God does not want us to be timidly compliant in the face of wrongdoing. But has your anger caused you to sin? Have you been able to control your anger and use it as a motivation for change? Or is anger that quick retort, that sharply barbed comment, that raised voice, that type of anger that has actually made the situation worse and destroyed any hope of resolution, although there is no hopelessness in resolution with Christ? But you know the sensation, if you're a human, that, you know, seeing those spots between your eyes or feeling that rush of blood or the tightening of the skin, the quickening of the pulse, and the desire to set wrongs right now. What will you do? I like the psalmist in Psalm 4:4. I think he's talking to himself. I believe he's talking to his own soul. And Paul will later quote him in Ephesians. But the psalmist says, be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Well, there's a path there. And we're going to see how Nehemiah followed that path. Because the next step, even though his emotions were stirred, the next step for Nehemiah was, we see this in verse 7, he thought seriously about the situation. He didn't fly into a rage. He didn't say, you always this and you never that. Nehemiah was a thinker. And he was wise. I've not always been wise like Nehemiah. I was thinking of a time that my emotions were so stirred, and I said, well, before I go to bed, I'm going to take care of this. And I fired off an email to this person. And I woke up the next morning and read what I had written. I'm like, couldn't I have changed the wording just a little bit? That didn't sound very nice. But it's too late, right? Well, we can ask for forgiveness. But isn't it amazing when we stop and consider and think like Nehemiah did, how our anger and our emotions can actually be useful, because it motivates us, but then God gives us wisdom, and we're acting in His strength and not in our own. We should never, as parents, discipline our children with that first rush of emotional anger, but because they did something that displeased us, but we should have, in the same way as Nehemiah did, that serious thought before we move into anything else. I think for Nehemiah, knowing him, serious thought meant prayer as well. He prayed. So that's the second thing. Nehemiah also spoke the truth with clarity. He may have been slow to speak, but when it was time to speak, he didn't hem and haw. He said it exactly how it was. You have been exacting usury from your brothers. Now we come to that word usury. And here is where, in my studies, I sort of found myself in the weeds for a while. Because the question arises among Christians today, are Christians allowed to charge interest on their money, especially to other Christians? And it's a controversial subject. I know that the Word of God has directions for us. So as I studied this, I thought, well, can I include all this in this sermon? I thought, you know what, this subject itself is a sermon in itself. And so that's coming later sometime. I want to spend more time studying on the subject of borrowing and lending for Christians today. And I'm open to your thoughts and your advice and your own experiences about that. But I want to point this out. In this situation, God's command to the Jews was very clear. Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20. This is God. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food, or anything that is lent out at interest. To a foreigner, you may charge interest, but to your brother, you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. Can't get much clearer than that, right? As Nehemiah spoke the truth, he was firmly anchored in the Word of God. Nehemiah also leaned on established practices, things that they had already done. Look at verse 8. He said, in the past, like this has been an issue, and we have been working really hard at redeeming our brothers out of slavery. We've been working on this, and now you're coming and putting our brothers back into bondage again. So as we face controversy or the potential for controversy, I just offer this, that sometimes it's good to go back and look at decisions that have already been made by our people or by our brothers and say, well, why did we make that decision then? Does it give us any information for this particular instance and case right now? It's good to look back at something that has been solid and has worked and has been a blessing for our people in the past. And in their case, they had been working very hard at redeeming their poor brothers from slavery before. He also appealed to their witness among the nations. Verse 9. Our motivation for doing what we do is not for ourselves. But being who we are and doing what we do, people are going to notice. We studied about that in our Sunday school this morning. People are going to see. Will God be glorified? Will all men know that we are Christ's disciples when they see us? Nehemiah said, should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? What will the enemies of God say when they see this? Something we should think about. Nehemiah also referred to his own example in verse 10. He goes into more detail about that in the end of the chapter, and we'll look at that. And then Nehemiah is also expectant and sure that they are able to change. I think this is very key as we think about resolving conflict. He told them what they needed to do. And I think he was confident that they were going to be able to do it. He didn't say, this is your problem. Deal with it. He helped them with finding a solution. In fact, he even uses words to associate himself with them. Let us stop this usury, he says in verse, is that verse number 10? We can do this together by showing that we trust someone and in their ability to change. We're actually helping to empower them to make that change. And I think the opposite is true too. If we give the idea or the opinion or have the attitude that this is just how you are, you can't change, it's going to be difficult for that person to make the change. One of the most incredible things in this story is success of Nehemiah. The success of Nehemiah's approach. The people who had been living this way and had been exacting usury from their brothers, they just listened to Nehemiah's speech and his rebuke. And then they said, we will do what you say. They didn't argue. They didn't try to defend themselves. They didn't attempt to explain their reasonings or say, well, but Nehemiah, you don't understand. This is why we've done this. Or they didn't say, well, Nehemiah, you know, his approach was way off base. He didn't really come to me in a spirit of humility, or he didn't know all the facts. They just listened. And they said, okay, we'll do what you say. I've been around a little bit in life, and I've experienced some things in life. The gift of accepting rebuke like this is a gift of grace from God. And I want to encourage you all in that, and I want to be more like that too myself. Instead of resisting reproof, let's take the advice of the proverb writer who says that it's an honor when someone thinks of you well enough to reprove you so you can change. It's an honor to receive that. Let's receive that. Okay, Nehemiah also initiated and established accountability. He got them to make an oath. Because, you know, words are one thing. I say, yeah, we'll do what you say. You know, in our accountability group sometimes we say, well, next month I want to do this, or I want to change this. I want to make sure I pray 15 minutes every morning. That's our goal. We write it down. But it's really helpful when my brother, who's in my accountability group 2 weeks into this month, messages me or asks me, well, how is your commitment to praying more going? And Nehemiah held these people accountable. And he did it in a way that is just kind of unique. It's not repeated anywhere in the Bible. Where is that? Verse 13. Where he gives this very vivid example, this very vivid object lesson of he shakes out his robe and says, this is how it's going to be. Every person who doesn't abide by what they say, God will shake him out. And can you imagine a man like Nehemiah, dignified as he is, in front of these rulers, that he's not afraid of people. He was the king's cupbearer after all. He's shaking his robe and showing them and everything that we hold dear, everything that we hold tightly to, whether it's our wallets or anything else, our reputation. He's just saying in a very vivid way that God is able to take you and the thing that you're grasping to, he's able to cause you to release that. It's better to make that choice yourself. And we've seen that in life sometimes, haven't we? Where people have clutched onto things that they shouldn't have clutched onto, and God had to use some methods that weren't as pleasant to remind them that they should have sacrificed them. They should have given them up. Okay, I will read verses 14 to 19 now. Moreover, from the time I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provision. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. Indeed, I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. And at my table were 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around us. Now that which was prepared daily was one ox and six choice sheep. Also fowl were prepared for me, and once every 10 days an abundance of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions because the bondage was heavy on this people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. And we think of that array, that table, and we just like, wow, we were talking about that a little bit at home, how that must have been 150 people. And this was not over the course of 52 days. If we look at the story, Nehemiah was governor for 12 years, and during the duration of his leadership, this is his consistent practice. He fed people. He provided for their needs. And besides those who came from other nations with the amounts of food that were prepared, imagine that, you who like to cook and barbecue, it could have been a couple hundred more people that sat in his dining room on a daily basis. Incredible. We read here, we learn four things that Nehemiah embodied: self-denial. He had a right to things, but he chose not to take them. On the other hand, he exemplified generosity. He was a generous person. He would have had a right to things, but he chose to generously give them away. And he's a model. He's an example for us. He was motivated by the fear of God. He mentions it twice in this chapter. It wasn't popularity. It wasn't a feel-good experience. He did it, what he did, because of the fear of God. And then we read this in verse 18. Nehemiah did what he did because he was moved with compassion. He saw the burden of the people. And he said, well, I can alleviate their burden a little bit by providing them a steak dinner or a chicken dinner or a dinner of mutton, I guess, right? Amazing. He took care of the people that he led. Who does this remind you of? It reminds me of Jesus. And I think I've said repeatedly in this series that Nehemiah is a type of Jesus Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. So as we think about walls coming down between builders, ponder these words: selfishness destroys, servanthood builds. Selfishness divides, servanthood unites. Selfishness controls, servanthood redeems. Selfishness puts walls between brothers, and servanthood allows brothers to build walls together. Let's not allow the ultimate takeaway from this story to be limited to the idea of financial usury. I'd like for us to ask this question to ourselves, and I want to ask this to myself. Am I exacting usury from my brother and my sister? Am I using them for my own advantage? Am I controlled by my selfishness? Am I guilty of controlling others? Do I have a burden for the burden of my brothers and sisters? And when I am rebuked, am I quick to repent and change? Now we come to verse 19, the last verse, and we could look at that and say, Nehemiah, that's not too humble. That sounds kind of proud. Remember me, O my God, for what I've done. Nehemiah didn't write this for the people. I think he wrote this. I think I've said this before. This was a journal that Nehemiah wrote that was written under the inspiration of God. Nehemiah may never have thought that we would be looking at this in our sermon today in 2025. This is what he wrote before the Lord. And he was just holding God to his promises that God had made, that if you're faithful, if you're good, you do what I tell you to do, I will bless you. I think of the song, and I hope we can sing it at the end, the one verse of Amazing Grace, that we can sing the whole song, but I thought of the phrase, the Lord has promised good to me. His promises are still true.